Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
I'm Jay Moran.
I'm Bridget Jaipal Valenza.
I'm Thomas O'Neill White.
We need to get together and let our voices be heard.
This is What's Next, a dedicated hour to have important conversations about the issues facing the marginalized and underrepresented communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario.
If we're going to have some real healing, we've got to have space to tell some uncomfortable truth.
What's Next continues our mission to discuss race,
equity,
and the common concerns of Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
And good morning. Welcome to What's Next. Our guest this morning from the University of Buffalo, Associate Professor of Counseling, School, and Educational Psychology, Dr. Catherine Lee Osruch. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
A pleasure for sure. As a matter of fact, for those who are ardent listeners to WBFO, they may be familiar with Dr. Lee Osruch's work because last week, the start of the school week, Ryan Zunner caught up with the doctor to talk about an issue that's becoming quite popular here as we start off the school year, and that's cell phone use in the classroom.
Everyone has a cell phone in their pocket, and if you're an educator or parent of a student, you know teens are no exception. But what is the balance between technology and classroom learning? Teachers in many districts have complained that phones are a distraction to students, texting, scrolling TikTok, and playing games while lessons are being taught. When students in Lackawanna return to the classroom later this week, they'll have a new policy where phones must be placed in a locked bag. Some districts across the state have similar rules, while Governor Kathy Hochul explores a statewide policy. But are these a holistic preventative or reactionary? School counseling and psychology professor at UB, Dr. Catherine Lee Osruch, thinks it's the latter.
You need to start really having a focus on how do cell phone use and using virtual spaces impact identity development. And not just the clickbait headlines about how it's detrimental, but ultimately how holistically is it impacting identity development?
Gen Z is the generation whose development has had one constant: smartphones and social media. According to research done by IBM, 3 out of 4 Gen Zers say their primary free time activity is spent online. And data from the firm Harmony Healthcare show Gen Zers lead generation groups in average screen time at a little over 6 hours a day. That might sound like an addiction.
Cell phone use and gaming and iPads, you know, how that has shifted students neurologically and how for many it has become an addiction, even with adults. And so, as we know with addictions and substance use and recovery, you can't just take the stimulus away. You can't just take the substance away. When it comes to teachers competing with technology, there's no race. You know, technology wins.
So how do you strike a balance? Dr. Lee Osruch says curriculum and professional development of those in education is a start.
As a school counselor, we have the ability to create curriculums that are focused on prevention and at different tiers. So we have the school-wide tier, which is the first tier. And within that tier, many of their interventions are classroom guidance lessons. And this gives school counselors the opportunity to engage in topics about responsible use of technology, as well as some of the concerns that are raised about technology when it comes to privacy and identity.
Lee Osruch believes in many ways, conversations around cell phone policy in schools is similar to conversations around sex education curriculum.
How do we engage in these dialogues? How do we decide what's going to be the responsibility of the school and what's going to be a conversation that the parent has? And so in a similar mind with how we think about sexual health, you know, it's messy, it's complicated, it's very personal. It is an aspect of who we are. As much as we don't like to think about technology in that relationship, this generation has that relationship with the technology. And so I think it's a similar process. You know, just like with abstinence-only education, there's going to be proponents for it and people who are against it.
Governor Hochul, on her statewide listening tour among school districts and parents this summer, seems to be one of those against smartphone use, citing mainly mental health and a study by Common Sense Media showing teens get about 200 texts and social media notifications per day.
It's hard enough for adults to pull themselves away from cell phones. I can't imagine how hard it is for these young people as well. But also, it's time to start figuring out solutions here. The status quo is not working for our children in particular. And I want to make sure we continue to incorporate community feedback. I want to hear from more parents and hear from more teachers. So we're going to focus on this.
Ultimately, the governor's office would have to craft and pass a bill in the New York State Legislature, which doesn't reconvene until January. Ryan Sunner, WBFO News.
All right. Well, we heard Ryan there with his report from last week, first week of school, and with us now live on What's Next, Dr. Catherine Lee Osruch. So you heard the report there, Dr. Lee Osruch, and let's maybe just, I don't even know where to start with it. Part of me wants to get into the politics of it a little bit, but maybe let's go to a conversation you and I were having just before we went on the air, a conversation that you had with your father, compared television to cell phones. And I remember, you know, early television watcher, I was, you know, coming of age when cable was breaking out, we could watch TV 24 hours a day. But you say there's almost really no comparison.
Yeah. So unlike television, where it's just one way, you know, you're getting fed the information, you absorb it, you know, kind of through osmosis, right? Like I'm getting all this information and making sense of it, or I'm just getting entertained by it. But it's one way, where the technology that we have today in this age of information is reciprocal. It's interactive, and you know, that's different. I don't have a relationship with my television, right? I don't see myself in the TV. Like, I get entertained by it. It provides a stimulus. You know, provides information. But I don't have an aspect of myself in that TV, so to speak. Of course, that's changing because their TVs today are smart.
Right.
So we can, you know, I think that in itself has shifted, you know, even that analogy, because many of us now have profiles. But still, it's specifically for, you know, content and, you know, being fed that content more so than engaging and being interactive with it.
So, and the interesting part of it also is how the cell phone, again, we don't look, there's a lot of ways of looking at it, right? I look at it my own way. I mean, again, it replaced the phone that used to be in the wall at my house. So that's one way of looking at it. But I'm obviously considerably older than the types of users that we're talking about here, school age and such. But it's, like you said, it's a part of people's identity, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. So, unlike when we think of technologies, there's even technologies like adaptive technologies, you know, adaptive assistive technologies. So I may have a limb that has technologies in it that I use, right, for my body. And it's an extension of my body, but it's a tool. It's to help me, you know, have access and move around. And so in some ways, cell phones provide that. They may provide some access. You may have some, for instance, like language interpretation. So you may be a student in the classroom whose first language is not English. And so you're using your cell phone, your device, even teachers do this, to help with interpreting in the classroom. But then when it comes to identity, and when I'm speaking of specifically about the extension of self, I'm thinking specifically about how social media has come into that milieu, right? Where we have our profile, we list our identities, and we engage with the world in a way in which we're representing ourselves, or aspects of ourselves. And, you know, it doesn't take much to kind of test that out, right? Like, think of the last time you were on a social media site and you posted something and somebody didn't like it, or somebody, you know, made a very, you know, derogatory statement or rude comment, and how you felt. And people take it personally. And so, and the reason for that is because it's not just something where it's like a business card, right? Where it's just, here's my information. Like, I don't look at a business card and say, that's me. Like, right. If somebody were to tear my business card up, I might be a little insulted, but I'm not going to think of it as a personal attack. Whereas, you know, even my LinkedIn page, if someone were to, you know, go on it and make a comment about my research or, you know, really, which is happening to a lot of academics right now, right? it would feel different. It would feel I would feel harmed. I'd be maybe even concerned, right, in terms of it being threatening to myself. And so that's where I'm saying that it's becoming an extension of who we are, our identity, as much as what we don't like that.
Right.
We don't like to think about it in that way.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're bringing a lot of nuance and complexity to something that is an issue that seems, you know, again, we heard how the governor addressed it. And I don't want to put words in her mouth, but I'll just try to characterize it as a kind of a, there was no real gray matter there that, you know, children are having too much difficulty learning because of these cell phones.
Mm-hmm.
And your thought is we can't fall into that simplistic of a notion.
Yes. And in education, we tend to do that. We write curriculum that, you know, is one size fits all. Because it's difficult. It's difficult to create curriculum that's based on our community's needs and the outcomes that we're looking for and resources. And so we tend to make these blanket, you know, curriculum or policies and say, okay, let's see if it works. Even with interventions, we see this in school counseling. You know, we've got these great interventions that could be school-wide, but if a school is handed it and they're not provided the training, they're not provided the support and resources, then it's not going to be practiced with fidelity. And the outcomes that you're looking for ultimately aren't going to come to surface. And I think that's, for me, that's where the conversation is missing is, okay, so you're doing this ban. What are you doing outside of that? Like, what's the and? I'm doing this ban and...
Right.
I'm providing a space where students can socialize, knowing that most of our schools in Western New York don't have recess. And, you know, when I was working in St. Louis School District as a school counselor, they had recess. Mm. The kids are out. It wasn't just lunch and it was outside. When
right.
I lived in San Diego, you know, their environment's a little different, but their setup was, you know, students were actually able to get outside and engage with each other. How are we providing those spaces when it comes to, you know, the concern about privacy and their concern about how students are using it for bullying or, you know, for harm? Okay, what are you doing to address that? So I think the ban is reactionary, like most things that we do,
right.
Especially in education. But my question is, okay, so you're doing it. So what's the end? What are you doing alongside that to address the actual root causes? And how are schools thinking about what are their specific needs and what are the specific outcomes they're looking for? Because each school is going to be different. There's probably some things like distraction that are similar across the board. You know, I mentioned it before. I have my mother's a special education teacher in Jamestown School District. My brother is a history teacher in Salamanca School District. And we've had conversations and they both are like, yeah, there's no competition. And I'm like, yeah, definitely. There's not. You can't compete with something that's providing an instant stimulus. But in that regard, if your concern is behavior and you're taking away a stimulus, right? What are you doing to replace that? Are you thinking about your teaching and how you're re-engaging students? And that's going to be difficult too. So you have students that are used to this instant gratification in need. And now we're asking them to slow down, right? When their brains are used to like going a million miles a minute. Now we're asking them to slow down and re-engage in this space, in this classroom. How are you supporting that transition?
I think that I really appreciate the way you're framing that for sure. And I'm wondering about how much you would understand. I mean, I know you've done a lot of research, but and like you just mentioned, two family members you probably have these conversations with. But is there enough talk about and focus in education, whether it's on a counseling level or in the classroom teaching, on just that? Integrating the use of cell phones, that they don't necessarily have to be an enemy of concentration and learning.
I think for some school districts that have the resources, there are those conversations because they have smart classrooms, or they may not be in their gen ed classes, but perhaps their advanced classes. You know, they have students engaged in programming, or they have students engaged in like higher level computer sciences. And so they're able to have those conversations because they have the technology to support those that learning. And I think for the majority, unfortunately, especially when you're looking at like the city school districts and those districts that are rural and under-resourced, they may not have even a smart board in their classroom. And so education is always behind as well, because mostly because of resources. And so while yes, I think you could eventually have those conversations, I think it's going to take time. And I think that's another area too, where sometimes the reaction, you know, it happens, but then it doesn't necessarily lead to the outcomes that you're looking for, because you're not thinking about the resources, you're not taking into consideration the time that it's going to take to transition. And so while this may, you know, impact the culture for, you know, little ones like elementary school kiddos that are right now starting off in kindergarten, and you're saying, okay, no cell phones, and it's to them, it's like, okay, you know, this is new, this is how school is. And so they're able to adapt to that culture because they have that time, right? That transition right. time. You're thinking about teenagers right now. Okay, you take away that device, like it's going to take them, it's going to be a more difficult transition. In some cases, not for all, but I would say for some. And so time is something to consider.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting also about the idea of being a reaction. And I'm wondering, I think what I'm hearing you for the most part, you know, advocating for is let's try to take our time here. Let's see if we can't maybe see what's ahead in this playing field before we make a move. Would you be in favor of like a pilot program or something like that? Or have you even given consideration to how perhaps that could be tested out? Like you said, there's going to be a reaction to taking away this stimulus from students. Mm-hmm. If it's a total ban, you know, how could we perhaps get an understanding of what that impact might be before, like you said, we dive in with this black and white measure that just changes, you know, the course of education and maybe not in a positive fashion?
So, you know, my question now to the school districts that are enforcing it is how are you measuring it? How are you evaluating it?
Right.
So, okay, you have aims. Hopefully, you have some goals and some outcomes that you're looking for. How are you evaluating it? Whether or not it's effective? Because too often, again, we do something as a reaction. Which, you know, I'm not saying it's good or bad. Like there is a significant issue with cell phones. And I understand why districts are putting in a ban, especially when it comes to the limitations with like bullying, for instance. Like they can't give out consequences to youth who are online at home for actions that are happening online because it's not in the school district and therefore it's not, you know, within their power. And so that leaves them with a lot of limitations, right? And so it makes sense to me why this is the protective measure, right? When you look at it from a protection standpoint. But when looking at, okay, you're actually wanting to make systemic change, if you're really aiming for a change in their learning outcomes, if you're really aiming for a change in their behaviors, how are you evaluating it, to your point? And I think that's going to vary upon school district, but I think where like academics like myself and my colleagues in information sciences and learning and instruction, they have computer science and teaching that they're starting up, you know, that's where, you know, we could really help in facilitating, okay, here's some curriculums about, you know, data privacy. Here's some curriculums about how to, you know, relationship building, like counseling, right? Like, what's the difference between having a relationship online compared to a relationship in person? Things like that, I think, is definitely something that we could create and pilot. To your point, you know, there are schools that do it for a short time basis. I think I'm trying to remember the school district, but it was in the South that was piloting having a cell phone ban. Okay. And they just said, like, we're going to pilot it. We're not putting it in permanently, but we're going to pilot it for a year. We're going to evaluate and we're going to see, is it actually doing the things that we're wanting it to do? Is it actually impacting students in terms of behavior, in terms of their social relationships, and in terms of their learning?
Do we have any sense of what they learned from that or not necessarily yet?
Yeah, I should have looked at the school. But yeah, I can't remember. It was in, I guess it was in the South. It might have been Virginia. But the principal, because they had done it for a year. And from my memory, they said, you know, they did see improvements in terms of behavior and in terms of social and peer relationships. But the learning wasn't like a significant jump. So it wasn't something that they looked at and go, oh, the correlation is so strong. Like we could definitely see where this has like a significant impact. But, you know, they were going to continue it for another year. to continue to see, okay, how is this helping, and what is the impact on the children and in learning?
And then, you know, beyond learning, let's maybe just talk about the, what we call it, mental or emotional health of students.
Mm-hmm.
Again, it's kind of become a simplistic notion that it's so much more difficult for a child today. The pressure on them mentally and emotionally is only increased by the social media and how they're being, I'll use the term, bombarded by messages and information. But I'm wondering if, you know, what you might have an understanding about that. Is that maybe a little over the top when it comes to assessing the impact on younger people right now?
So it is a concern. It is something that is
because
happening.
Because they were worried about TV when I was a kid.
Yeah, similarly. And, you know, you do see where anxiety is up and depression is up. And I have heard from counselors that, you know, we have a process. There's 504s and then there's IEPs. And 504s are specifically for medical accommodations. And typically you see students who have, let's say, like an ADHD diagnosis or perhaps like a temporary disability. So they got into a car accident, their leg is broke, so they need extra time to get to class. So those types of accommodations that could be provided in the classroom. And these school counselors that I've been talking with have been saying that there's an increase in 504 requests from parents for accommodations due to anxieties and due to depression. And the difficulty there is that there is a difference between anxiety that is clinical, same with depression, right? A clinical diagnosis of anxiety and depression, and anxiety that is a natural reaction to what's happening in the world, which right now there's
right.
There's a lot happening.
right, there's a lot happening.
There's a lot happening. And so it's a difficult time. It's a difficult time for youth, and it's a difficult time for families. And I think when it comes to mental health, while technologies, I think, exacerbate that, I believe that there is more nuance when specifically thinking about anxiety and depression as to what's happening and how much of that is the technology or how much of that is a reaction and them trying to cope with what is happening.
Right.
So it's complicated.
Yeah, no doubt. And I appreciate the conversation as well. And I'm also, and I'm going to let you kind of run with this a little bit, but that reaction, like we've said, that, okay, cell phones are interrupting learning, got to put a halt to them, you know, restrictions and such like that. But at the same time, and I don't want to ask, do you see the benefits of having cell phones? But at the same time, are we missing the possibilities that this technology is offering students in this type of conversation?
I think so. I think there are ways that you could use the technologies, like you said, in the classroom with resources. If the, you know, the classroom has the resources to do it, you can engage students and having them, like even my graduate students, you know, I struggle. I know colleagues in higher ed that struggle to integrate technology still in the classroom. But, you know, I had students that, you know, would create infographs about the topic, the content. So it was, you know, think about how you would share information about different, like, for instance, like anxiety or bullying, right. You know, and have that as an infographic for parents. Or, you know, AI is now the conversation as well, right? Like, you know, how are we integrating that within the classroom? And I had a student who last year had a presentation and they used AI and they used AI to create an artwork based off of their experience. And then in the presentation, they actually described what that artwork meant for them and how it aligned with the meaning that they made from their experience. And so there's really, and this is, they came up with it. I didn't even, you know, give that prompt. And I think it was a really good demonstration of how you could integrate those technologies in the classroom in a meaningful way. That's still demonstrating the learning of the student while also, again, using the technologies rather than consuming it. And so I think there are ways to do it. I think as a school counselor, one of the other ways in which I've seen that cell phones specifically have been helpful is for youth who are in crisis. You know, as school counselors, many of them have caseloads of over 200 students. Mm. And as much as what they would like to be with every student at every time that they're in crisis or know, you know, if a student is struggling, they're limited. And there have been, you know, youth when I was a school counselor in elementary school that would text the crisis line. And they would be in class and they would, you know, be having a conversation with the crisis hotline.
Wow.
And, you know, consulting with them. And then they would let their teacher know. But they were already accessing the support. So by the time they got to me, they had already had that contact. They were already being assessed. And so it was just a matter of connecting with a parent and, you know, creating a safety plan and making sure that they were okay. Right. But that's a way, right? Students being able to have that access who may not even have a relationship with me yet as a school counselor because I haven't seen them yet. But they know that this is a resource that they can instantly, okay, I'm not feeling right now. I'm having these suicidal thoughts or thinking about harming myself. So I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to text this hotline. I'm going to have this conversation with a therapist.
Wow. Yeah. I appreciate that example for sure. We're going to continue our conversation here in just a little bit. We're talking with Dr. Catherine Lee Oshrus, assistant professor of counseling, school and educational psychology at the University of Buffalo. We'll take a time out. This is What's Next on WBFO.
Hey, educators, you've been asking for it and it's here. Reading Rainbow Stories is ready to help your students stay on track. Each story is paired with activities to help students strengthen cross-curricular skills such as math and business in Lemonade for Sale.
Let's keep track of our sales.
Science and health in Germs Make Me Sick.
Usually, you feel better after a day or two.
Thanks.
But if you don't, you should see a doctor.
And history in Following the Drinking Gourd.
One of the worst things about slavery is that families were separated. Fathers, mothers, and children were oftentimes sold to different people.
Check out the new Reading Rainbow Stories collection on PBS Learning Media today to help your students stay on track.
Attention, parents and teachers. Find free learning resources, including lesson plans and videos for all ages at pbslearningmedia.org.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back to What's Next. Our guest, Dr. Catherine Lee Oshrus, Assistant Professor of Counseling, School and Educational Psychology at the University of Buffalo, spent the first part of our conversation getting into the possibility of cell phone bans in the classroom. But we have an opportunity here with Dr. Lee Oshrus to also maybe expand on a conversation here a little bit with some of our other topics and subject matter that are very interesting. Going into your UB profile, one of your publications, Distributive Justice for Native American Indigenous People Within Counseling. So, I want to be careful how I venture into this because I only know so much about it, but the title is most certainly intriguing. And I guess just to that, well, let's just start with Distributive Justice. What do you mean by that in the title?
Mm-hmm. So distributive justice refers to allocation of resources. And in, you know, there's different theories of justice. And when we think of distributive, we think of, again, like resource allocation. So when it comes to Native Americans and counseling, it could look like scholarships for entry into graduate programs to be trained as clinicians. It can look like, you know, funding to support clinics that are on reservations and make sure they have those resources. But it also looks like representation. So how many faculty in higher ed, how many educators, how many clinicians are actually Native American who are able to serve their communities. And distributive justice is that. How are we thinking about allocation of resources? And when it comes to Native American nations and peoples, you know, they tend to be the last that are thought of, unless they're really strong in terms of advocacy. And, you know, we're fortunate that the nations here in the Haudenosaunee, have resources and are really strong in advocating. But there are some nations that are rather small and maybe not even federally recognized, but are state recognized, that this is an area that is a real struggle for them to have that representation.
So clearly you are seeing that. That's the case in various communities, Native communities across the United States, that they are lacking, whether it's in representation or resources. I mean, I guess just as I say it, I almost feel like it's obvious. But if you could expand a little bit, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, each nation is different. Right. And so there are some nations that, again, have more resources and are better equipped to advocate. And, you know, other nations that are smaller, like I'm thinking in San Diego County, you had some that were very small and in very rural areas. Like when we think of rural here in Western New York, you know, it's maybe, you know, one house, you know, half mile down the road, where in very rural areas in the Southwest and the coast, it could be a few miles before you see the next house. So when it comes to distributive justice, they're definitely, again, thinking about indigenous communities. They're not a primary focus. They tend to be second or last. You know, even in the city of Buffalo, when you mention the Seneca Nation or any of the nations within the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, people tend to think about the res, right? They think about Salamanca. They think about the Finger Lakes region, the Tuscarora Nation, but they don't think about Niagara Falls. They don't think about the city of Buffalo.
Right.
We're on territory here in the city. You know, this is indigenous lands. And there is a very, you know, there's a significant presence of indigenous peoples here in the city of Buffalo. But when I'm hearing conversations about development, you know, urban development, revitalization, I'm not hearing an inclusion of, you know, those people, those communities, those nations.
And to that then, you know, bringing that down more into the school counseling type of area, then we're seeing impacts of this type of thinking upon younger Native students.
Mm-hmm. So within a school district, they get allocated funding to support Indigenous students, specifically when it comes to like language revitalization, cultural education, and so that's Title VI funds. And so each district, depending on the amount of students that are registered, gets a pot of funds. And those funds are supposed to be spent on supporting Indigenous students' programming. That's not always the case. So
kind of goes into a pool, and
it's similar to Title I funding, right? You have a certain amount of students who fall below the poverty level, and you get allocated as a district this amount of funding to support programs that are supposed to support those youth. I know, like for instance, when I lived in St. Louis, there was history where the school districts were using Title I funds to support programming that were actually serving students that were the minority in terms of social class, right? A higher social class and wealth. And it was typically with like advanced classes, advanced programming.
Wow.
And so, you know, when it comes to distributive justice, from a school district standpoint, it's even examining that. Like, okay, how are you, do you have a committee for your parents? You know, are you supporting the director of your Title VI funds in the district to be able to create programming? Are you ensuring that principals are aware of the fact that this funding exists and that Indigenous students have a right to these programs, especially in regards to like language revitalization, and that you're doing what you can to coordinate with the Title VI coordinator for the district to provide those programs? The difficulty, especially in urban areas, is that you have many students who are mixed. And so oftentimes when a student is enrolled, I went through this as someone who's biracial, you know, you check a box and even if the demographic questionnaire allows you to check more than one box, when you're actually inputted into the system, and they're doing an annual report or they're looking at, achievement, the boxes sometimes prioritize one identity over the other. And so for many students who are Native, let's say for instance, they're Seneca and they're Hispanic. And so they check, you know, Hispanic under ethnicity, and they check Indigenous under race, even though indigeneity is citizenship more so than race. When they pull a report, when they look at demographics and they're pulling data, it's just going to name that student as Hispanic in many cases.
Okay.
And so there are some difficulties that districts run into when really trying to source how many students do we have who are Native, who are those students? And then for the Title VI coordinator, how do I provide, how do I connect with those students? And so I do want to, you know, say that there are those barriers, but I also know, you know, that, you know, there are folks who are in school districts right now. I've met several, you know, Title VI coordinators, and, you know, they run into challenges where they're trying to create programming, they're trying to get into the school and connect with their students, and the door's shut in them, on their face. So when it comes to distributive justice, again, it's really looking at, okay, where's the money being spent?
Right.
And also, if there are supports that are supposed to be in place, specifically for Indigenous students, are school districts really prioritizing that? Are they doing their best effort, right, best effort based on resources to provide that?
And it sounds like you do have this information to a certain extent anecdotally. This mm-hmm. is not, you know, hard data science, but this is a real thing that the Section 6 coordinator, mm-hmm. Title VI coordinators, they're doing their job, but maybe it's not being prioritized at the administrative level.
Mm-hmm.
That's happening.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, part of an essential part of the role, too, is to register students. And so especially in urban areas, you have, again, students who are of mixed identity. And each nation has their own way of registering citizenship. Some of it's matrilineal, some of it's patrilineal, some of it's, you know, percentage. And we can have a whole conversation about blood quantum and the colonialization of that process. but each nation has their own laws and processes around citizenship. And one of the important roles of the Title VI coordinator is to help in ensuring that students who have the right to become a citizen are enrolled. Even students who are descendants, they may not be able to enroll as a citizen, but they can still be connected to resources because you still want them to be, you know, have connections, right? Have connections to the community, have connections to the nation, have connections to their culture. And so when there's barriers to that, it ends up resulting in a decrease in enrollment and citizenship for the tribal nation, which then has repercussions when it comes to federal recognition and state recognition.
Right.
And so, you know, here, you know, the Seneca Nation especially, right, is really strong, very present, and from my understanding right now, they're not having an issue with when it comes to citizenship and recognition. They're federally recognized. But you go, again, to smaller nations, like when I was working in California, in San Diego County, they have the largest population of Indigenous nations in a county, per county. But several of them are unrecognized federally. They're only state recognized. And it's because some of it is due to citizenship, because they don't have enough members enrolled. And there are cases where, you know, some nations have lost recognition because they have decreased in the amount of citizens. And so the Title VI coordinator in that process, in regards to distributive justice and representation, really has ramifications for the nations themselves when it comes to being recognized and having those privileges and upholding sovereignty.
Our guest this morning on What's Next is Dr. Catherine Lee Osruch, Assistant Professor, Counseling, School, and Educational Psychology at the University of Buffalo. Interesting part of your own personal background, and you mentioned it earlier as well, you're from the Jamestown area.
I am.
And I know you've also had an interesting path toward this field, but at the same time, your time growing up as a young person in a part of Western New York, Jamestown has its own unique characteristics, and I've learned that more and more every day. But how that may have influenced kind of where you're venturing here in terms of your research?
Mm-hmm. So I identify as biracial, so I actually am not Native, but in my early education, I remember attending the YWCA summer camp, girls' camp. And there was a gentleman who would, he was an elder, and he would come and volunteer once a week. And he was a white man, but he had a connection with the Seneca Nation. Now, I was 4 or 5 years old at the time, so I can't tell you what that connection is. And some of it, I even questioned myself, like, okay, what is that connection? But he would often, he would bring guests from the Seneca Nation and to talk with us. And I remember, you know, hearing stories and also history and also, you know, getting an understanding of the Seneca Nation and the land and, you know, being educated early on. Like I have my grandparents, they live in Wyoming County. Hmm. And so, you know, traveling there, we go through the reservation, we go through territory and across the river, you know, the Ohio and Allegheny River. And, you know, my mom would tell us about the dam and we would watch the levels, right? And, you know, she would say that you could still see, you know, where the houses were in the settlements. And I remember as a youth, like always looking to see if I could see where they were,
right.
Where they used to live before they were pushed out. And so, you know, growing up with that knowledge of place, especially like the history of this place, was really formative, especially someone who's biracial and you know, is white passing. You know, they often say mixed folks are struggling with their identity, but like having an understanding of at least the place and the space where I'm from helped with getting some grounding, right? Helped me with my own comfort in being who I am. Even though I didn't identify as Native, and I knew I wasn't.
Right.
And so as I grew older, and also in my engagement in being biracial and getting to know the Black community and the mostly mixed community in Jamestown, you know, really wanting to give back. And so I was very fortunate in high school. I received the Gates Millennium Scholarship. So I was a Gates Millennium Scholar. And I started off wanting to be a veterinarian, had been since the age of 9. And so I went to undergrad with that in mind. But, you know, throughout that experience, you know, Gates Millennium was always like, hey, what are you doing with it? You know, we're giving you this gift. We're paying for your education. What are you doing with it? How are you making an impact? How are you contributing back? And so that alongside some other experiences that I had within the field of agriculture itself, which I love, but is challenging when you're coming from the outside and trying to get in. That and, again, this push to make impact is really what led me to pursuing a career in counseling and thinking about how can I contribute back to this community. Now, it's taken some time because I did my PhD in St. Louis, and then I was in Montana for a year and then was in San Diego for 3 years. And so it took about 10 years. you know, when the opportunity arose, specifically the opportunity to engage in research that was outside of the ivory tower, so to speak, but really community engaged, I'm like, this is the time. They're ready for me. Buffalo is ready for me. You know, the Western New York is ready for this type of work. And so that's ultimately what brought me back and why I am so passionate about supporting specifically Black and Indigenous communities here in Western New York.
Let's take one more time out and we'll come up with our final moments with Dr. Catherine Lee Osruss. We're talking here on What's Next on WBFO.
Did you know that WNED PBS is always working on great new local shows for you to watch? Documentaries like Kleinhand's Gift to Buffalo, which tells the story of Buffalo's Music Hall.
The hall is very intimate, and that intimacy makes everyone who comes in here feel a part of our family.
Fun and educational series like Compact Science.
Believe it or not, peppers are technically fruits.
And Shakespeare's greatest hits featuring some of his best-known soliloquies and monologues.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of.
You can watch them all on our website at wned.org/local shows. While you're there, check out the show pages and mini websites for additional content such as bonus features, photo galleries, and lesson plans. Find it all at wned.org/local shows.
Explore the Underground Railroad's final stop. Learn about how the Latine workforce organized to overcome discrimination and follow the timeline of immigration in Western New York.
So remember, history surrounds you and includes you.
Watch Compact History on the Buffalo Toronto Public Media YouTube channel.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the WBFO app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@wbfo.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is WBFO, your NPR station.
And welcome back. Our guest this morning, Dr. Catherine Lee Osruch, assistant professor, counseling, school, and educational psychology at the University of Buffalo. Among your interests or your research focus, social justice within educational systems. Now, of course, it really has been a kind of our conversation has kind of weaved in and out of that. But it is interesting to talk about that. I mean, you've highlighted to a certain extent some of the things where justice is not happening in the educational system. Mm-hmm. From your perspective right now, as you see things, is it because of intent, or is it because, you know, it's just things get overlooked? You know, people, you know, it's all about priorities in school districts, and, you know, the priorities are A, B, C, and maybe not looking at some other elements. What do you say?
Intention is I think, a difficult concept, because in terms of, and I can get really into philosophy, but in terms of conscious awareness, right? Yeah. So I may intend to do a specific behavior, so I'm consciously aware of it that I'm doing this behavior, but am I consciously aware of the consequences of that behavior? And I think that's where it becomes difficult when trying to place accountability for the injustices that take place within systems, especially systems that are built to perpetuate specific inequities, right? So even just talking about Title VI, would I say that an educator in the classroom has knowledge of that? No. And actually, that's part of what I speak to in that paper is, in regards to counseling, you know, we have this ethic of being culturally competent and being able to serve all clients. But the majority of clinicians have little understanding of sovereignty, tribal sovereignty. They have little understanding of indigenous ways of knowing. Like, that's like, I would say, you know, higher tier, you know, you've had relationship with community, you've really dove into the literature and philosophy and talked with and have relationship with communities. But, you know, the majority of educators don't know that. Majority of educators don't know, or even mental health counselors don't know that, you know, the federal laws that are meant to protect indigenous communities and culture. And so how can you be culturally competent not knowing those federal laws?
Right.
And so, again, back to intention, like as an educator or as a principal or as someone, you know, I may think I'm doing good because I'm intending to by, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm combining the indigenous education folks in Title VI with another program within the school district, because if we put them together, they'll both be resourced better and we can allocate funding better. And so that's an action I take. But am I thinking about the potential consequence of that being that now people are, you know, misunderstanding or merging those two when they're completely separate entities that require specific competencies and specific supports and specific programming? And so, you know, I think that there are a few folks that have a very well-versed understanding of what they're doing and the actions and the consequences. But I would say the majority are, we're all just kind of cogs in the system.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where this battle with, you know, critical theory comes in, right? Because we're trying to change everybody, which is not the case, folks. really what it's doing, you know, is
expanding
is
knowledge.
We're trying to expand knowledge and understanding it. I'm not trying to influence.
Yeah, and it's interesting. And I want, because talking about your own personal background and talking about also maybe the lack of, like you said, sovereign awareness among teachers, among even counselors. You came out of Jamestown. It seemed like something that you wanted to focus on. It was personal. But to that, what more, you know, if you go through Salamanca now, you know, there's all sorts of signage and things reminding you that, you know, we're in, you know, you're on native land here. I mean, mm-hmm. It's an understanding. But you don't see that everywhere, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I guess what I'm wondering, maybe a larger conversation is where, you know, what should be the conversations that will help expand this understanding that could, you know, make for better outcomes for for children in schools?
So I am an advocate for requiring anyone who's being certified in education to have at least a foundational course in Indigenous context. I believe Syracuse University actually implemented this for all their degree programs not too long ago, where they had to take at least one credit in Indigenous studies, and it was their foundations course. And you know, you see it in states like Maine. Maine has this. Montana, when I lived in Montana for, you know, as conservative as Montana is, but Montana has a significant Native population, and they have Indian education for all. Now, could I say that everyone's practicing it with fidelity? No, but they have it on the books that this is the policy, and the majority of educators who you talk to at least have an understanding that there is a tribal nation, right? It's a nation, and that it has its own practices and policies that they have. You know, there's language revitalization. Students have rights that are different than non-Native students. And so I am a proponent of that. I would love to see that here in New York. You know, my colleague and I were working on a grant not too long ago where we were trying to find ways of integrating not only Indigenous contexts into our training of our school counselors, but also working with multilingual students. You know, we're hoping to apply for that grant, you know, this year. But some of the work that we were doing was in talking with, you know, having conversations with our Indigenous Studies department. Like, is there ways that our students could take a class?
Right.
Or, you know, they have so many opportunities that you get on their listserv and, you know, they'll share with you, like, here, we have these speakers that are coming in. We're doing the storytelling conference. We're, you know, having our social dances. We're having these lectures. And so there's plenty of opportunity for, you know, folks to engage and to form that basic understanding, right, that at least, you know, when they walk into a classroom and they have a Native student, they know or could ask questions, right, that are specific to that student.
And then we're going to maybe finish up with a kind of a personal question, maybe a little outside your maybe not, I wouldn't say expertise, I think it's right inside your expertise, but asking to extend that conversation, like you said, that was focused on, you know, what kind of competencies we could provide to mm-hmm. teachers, to counselors in schools. But what about the conversation in general, the general population? What could be done better to, you know, just increase that level of literacy, of understanding? I mean, I can just say for me, sitting in this chair for the last 2 years and some of the people who have come and spoke to me in that chair, I've, you know, been very fortunate to, you know, get a better understanding of the Seneca Nation here in Western New York and the Haudenosaunee. And I'm very pleased with that. But that's not something that we're getting in, you know, the general conversation that's going on. What about that? What do you think?
So I think that, again, like thinking about our Indigenous Studies, you know, department at the college, or at the university, I should say, you know, they have an opportunity, you can get on their listserv and they share with you all of these different events that you could attend. Lecture, you know, starting off with just that, going and attending an event, going and attending a lecture, you know, starting to understand not just the history, but really like what's happening right now. What is happening right now? Because they're here, they're thriving. And that's also something that's a stereotype, right? Is that Indigenous communities are in the past. You know, everything that happened had happened and nothing's happening right now. I also would really, what I'd really like to see as well as when it comes to the community organization level is to have some cross, you know, conversations. And there's politics there. You know, I can't say that, you know, the nations are themselves, you know, like we get protective, we get siloed.
Sure.
But I think at a community level, especially within the city of Buffalo, really trying to see some conversations taking place across organizations that support Indigenous students and support Black students, support Hispanic students or refugees and asylum seekers. So I think that in itself would be helpful. Like, were we providing those opportunities for those conversations to take place?
And we brought Dr. Lee Osrush in to talk to us this morning initially about cell phones in the classroom. Just curious, as we're winding down here, Do you have an idea, a feeling of where this might end up going? I mean, I know I appreciate your thought. Let's not be too reactionary about this, but how do you see it maybe playing out?
I mean, I'm a skeptic, if you haven't figured out. I'm a skeptic.
I don't know if I saw that.
There's my own personal opinion, right?
Yeah.
As a parent myself, like, there are things that I'm doing and being very conscious of, like whether or not I'm having my child online, if I'm online, you know, in terms of privacy, what that looks like. And then I step back and, okay, for others, you know, what would it look like? And I think I see this as being reactionary, see that there may be some conversation about how it's helped and improved. But my question is where's the data?
Well spoken. Well stated, for sure. Well, Dr. Catherine Lee Osruch, thank you so very much for coming in and talking with us today.
Thanks for having me.
This has been What's Next. Our guest, Dr. Catherine Lee Osruch, Assistant Professor of Counseling, School and Educational Psychology at the University of Buffalo. This has been What's Next on WBFO.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.